Previously on the Ron Van Dam Show.
If you're going to sleep in the same room with me, down the back of my throat, I know what I'm doing. It's not my first rodeo. What the hell does that mean, by the way?
And now, today's episode.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Come on, everybody. You know the words. Hey, welcome to the program. It is the Ron Van Dam Show. We do this every single weekday, no matter what. I know. There's something wrong. Something wrong with that. Why does the word stools have two meanings that are kind of weird? I mean, I know about the stool where you sit down on a like a chair with no back. That's a stool. And then there's stool samples where you're giving, like, your stool is your feces that, you know, comes out of your butt cakes. And I'm just thinking, why do they share the same word? Do we run out of words here? Do we run out of combinations of letters that we've got to have the same word for a chair with no backing and crap? I don't understand us. And this is why I don't sleep at night. You ever wake up in the morning to put your shoes on and you can't find one of your shoes? You've only got the left shoe. You can't find the right one. You look everywhere. Like, why would my shoes be separated like this? Did they have an argument overnight? And then you say screw it and you just put on the one shoe and you go throughout the day with the shoe on one foot and just your sock on the other. Does that happen to you? No? It's just me? Oh. I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm very archaic. I churn my own butter. I don't, I'm only kidding. I don't churn my own butter, you serious? They have butter in the supermarket. Why would I churn my own butter? I don't even know how to do it. I don't even know what a churn is. Is that a device? Is churning like stirring it? I don't know what a churn is, to be honest. And I'm not going to Google. I refuse to Google anymore. For now on, I'm going down to the library. Do you know when I was a kid, I rarely went to the library unless I was forced to, like arrested and brought to the library. I would never... That was a horrible experience. Oh my God, let me tell you this story. You're going to freak. You're going to say, wow, that really is cruel and unusual punishment, Ron. I know you're going to say that. Yeah, this is sick. This is a true story.
And now it's time for one of Ron's funny stories. You could practically hear the quotes around funny, couldn't you?
Do
happened about 12 years ago, so it's like yesterday. I was on a radio station, on a Boston Providence radio station, as I was for many years of my life, actually most of them. And there's a charity called Muscular Dystrophy. It's the Jerry Lewis thing. Rest his crazy asshole. It was Muscular Dystrophy time. And what they did was they would phony arrest people and bring them down to an undisclosed location where they would sit you in front of a telephone and you would call people up that you knew to request donations for muscular dystrophy. Okay. They tended to do that with city officials, prominent business people, and basically radio talk show hosts, assuming that because I talk to thousands and thousands and thousands of people every day, that I know everybody. I don't know you. So talk show hosts were like, and people in broadcasting and in television were the prime targets of being arrested. Now, you weren't actually arrested, of course. However, they did it in a very scary manner. I'd be doing the radio show, and I'd just be finishing up, and I'd come out of the studio, and the producer would say, there's a policeman in the lobby looking for you. And I thought, oh my God, what did I do now? Did they find out about me robbing that liquor store? You're like, oh my God, there's a cop looking for me in the lobby of the building. So I would walk out of the studio and there would be an officer and he'd come over and he'd say, Ron Van Dam? And I said, yes. And he'd say, you're under arrest. I didn't know she was only 13. He said, no, not that. He says, and I know you didn't know she was 13. He says, no, not that. By the way, that's a joke. These days, that joke is not all that funny. Unless you live in the South, then it's just normal. The police officer says, you're under arrest for muscular dystrophy. And I said, I did not know that was a crime. And he laughed and he said, you'll have to come with me. We're arresting you for muscular dystrophy and we're going to bring you to an undisclosed location for an hour or two and they'll explain it to you. I said, okay, officer, whatever. Because in those days I had no life. You know, so when you're off the air, there's just nothing to do but go to the bar and drink. So, you know, what the hell? He puts me into his police cruiser. I sat in the front seat with him. I don't know if most criminals sit in the front seat, but that's where I sat. And he brings me down to a Holiday Inn, which was about 3 miles away. And I walk in and he says, okay, it's good seeing you, Mr. Van Dam. Good meeting you. I thought, okay, it's a very friendly officer. And then I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, they're going to frisk me? Do I have any pot on me? And back then, that was not legal. But I didn't. So I walk into this gigantic room. There's telephones all over the place. These were the days where they had telephones, by the way, kids. Telephone, I'll explain what it is. It plugged into the wall. You could call people and talk to them, actually, and hear them. You kids don't understand that. So anyway, so I sat down at this desk, and there were like 10, 12 other people, and I knew most of them because they were prominent people in the area. And they said, please call as many people as you know and ask them to donate to muscular dystrophy. And I remember saying to them in a very probably demeaning manner, are you kidding me? Because I don't know anybody. They said, Ron, you know everybody. Please make some calls for us. So what I did was, and please don't get angry at me, I made believe that I called people, but I didn't. I don't like to beg for money. I really don't. Unless I was homeless. But these people, and muscular dystrophy is a wonderful, you know, a charity and stuff like that. But I can't do that stuff. I can't ask my friends for money or people I know for money. Hi, it's Ron. Can you donate $100? Oh, Ron, come on, not again, you know. First it was your dental work, and you needed money for that, and then it was to put your kid through college, and you know, anyway. So I made believe, so I just wrote down phone numbers of you know, people that I knew. And then after about 20 minutes, I said, nobody's really helping out and nobody's home. And they said, and by the way, I have a dental appointment this afternoon, which isn't true. I've never had a dental appointment. I hate dentists. I hate them. Not as people. As people, they're probably fine, although the suicide rate in dentists, I understand, is quite high. And I understand why a dentist would commit suicide, because they don't want to go see themselves either. So I made that up. I lied, and I said, I have a dental appointment and I really must leave. And I said, okay, we'll have Officer Schmucky take you back to the station where your car is. Thank you very much. But now, and then the officer, you know, he leaves me there at the station. I get in my car, and I say to myself, oh, my God, do I have an arrest record now? Well, no, because that was just a joking kind. My point is, why do we have to go through this gigantic charade of putting me in a police car and phony arresting me? I mean, like, why couldn't you just come over to the studio and said, Ron, can you go to the Holiday Inn for half an hour, make some phone calls? And I would have very happily said no. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Anyway, that's what happened to me.
And that was another funny story from Ron. Wait, that was supposed to be funny? Wow.
You are listening to The Ron Van Dam Show, the podcast world's version of painful itching and swelling. You know they sell a cream for that, right? It's over the counter. Works really well. I've had to use it a lot.
Here's a story that came across my little news desk, my tiny little news desk. And at first glance, I was appalled. I actually changed my name to Paul. I was appalled. I was a Paul bearer. I said, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. And the story is that Amazon, you know that big company, Amazon paid no federal taxes last year, nor the year before. And I was livid, because Amazon is like the largest worldwide company ever and makes a lot of money. Amazon's profits before taxes was $11 billion last year. In 2018. $11 billion. That's a lot of money. That's before paying out any taxes. But Ron, you just said that Amazon paid no taxes in 2018. Well, they paid no federal taxes is the real story. The federal tax system said, no, you don't have to pay. Amazon paid state and local taxes, depending on where they were taking up shop or distribution, but not federal. They didn't pay any federal taxes at all, nor did they do that in 2017, but even more so not in 2018. And one might say, okay, I paid federal taxes. Why didn't Amazon pay federal taxes? The largest pool of money ever. And here's the reason, apparently. The reason is Trump. But I thought Trump hated Amazon. He does. But in order for Trump to help his corporate friends, not Amazon, but the rest of them, you can't do a tax law and say, you guys get a tax break, but not Amazon because I don't like them. Although, if he could, he would. What Trump did was, with his tax package, corporations made out really, really, really well. That's because they were allowed to go back in time for quite a long period to show that they had losses. Amazon went all the way back to their startup days where they weren't turning profit and they were putting most of their money into distribution plants and that kind of thing. So this tax break, this federal tax break, took that into account going way back. As a result, Amazon ended up paying no federal taxes at all. Zero. Goose egg. Not a dime. Now, Amazon, again, does pay state and local taxes. They also pay payroll taxes. They also contribute to research and development in a very charitable manner as well. But all this is based on what Amazon accountants understand that they can get away with so that they don't pay any. Had they paid federal taxes, the amount would have been astronomical. That's the reason. I hear a lot of people walking around saying, Ron, did you read the news? Amazon paid no taxes last year. Well, they paid no federal taxes. But still, yeah, that's Trump helping the big businesses make sure. And in most cases, the big businesses have not raised the salaries of their workers either at all, or they have raised it in a very minuscule small amount. Workers are not walking away with gigantic jackpots based on taxes that Trump's tax package. Who is walking away smiling like crazy are the top of the heap of the businesses who now have more money in their pocket when they go home. So I don't know what to tell you, man. It's amazing to me. This is how you tell the I've said this before, man, and I'm just telling you, if you're going to listen to this show, you got to understand something. You got to keep up on the news. There's a lot of shit happening. And if you just say, I'm not interested, I don't have time, I'm not interested in that, it's all crap and I'm not interested, then you don't understand the deal. In other countries, in every other country, they care a lot. They argue about it. They're very vocal. In this country, more than half the people I run into, so what's going on in the world, Ron? Why are you asking me? Shouldn't you know? Don't you seek out that information? You don't have to know everything, but do you keep your ears open? That's not why I do this show, by the way, because I don't want to be serious all the time. I want us to have a good time as well, but, I mean, I'll keep you informed on the heavy shit. But go search it yourself. Be an American. Be a citizen. I don't care what your background is. Know what's going on. Know when things are good and know when you're being screwed so you can do something about it, especially in an election year, which is coming up really, really, really soon. Anyway, that's the deal with Amazon. And I must admit, I go to Amazon more than ever now. It's not that I don't like to go outside. It's more that I don't like to go outside. I like shopping. I like going to stores and perusing and browsing. I love it. I love it. I love it when people come up to me and say, can I help you? Can I help you? Can I help you? I love that subservient kind of attitude. So don't get me wrong. But it is convenient just to sit down at your stupid little laptop or computer or phone and just order something. And in most cases, Amazon will deliver it the next day. I've heard some stories where they deliver it later that day. I mean, come on, man. That's not bad. So I do dabble in the Amazon every once in a while. And I do get very excited when I order something and it shows up at my door. I don't get that excited when I buy it in a store and then bring it home. It's exciting, don't get me wrong, but it's not orgasmic exciting. However, when you go to your front door, just, you know, randomly, and you open it up and there's a package there, you know what's in it because you ordered it, but there's this kind of feeling at the front door like it's Christmas. I don't know what that is. I don't know how Amazon pulls that off. I expect a package to be there. I get pissed off when it's not. and I know exactly what's in the package. I ordered it the day before. My memory isn't that bad, although sometimes it is. Sometimes I'll get a package at the door, and I'll open the door, and I'll go, wow, this is exciting. I wonder what this is. Hey, schmuck, you ordered it the day before. You forgot? Yeah, that does happen. I need that Prevagen stuff, you know, that jellyfish stuff, some kind of chemical derived from jellyfish. I didn't think jellyfish had anything in them except for jelly. I've talked about this before. I've talked about everything. I'm starting to bore myself. I mean, if jelly will get my brain cells moving again, I'm just going to take a bath in grape jelly or something. I never liked grape jelly. I don't know why. I like other flavors of jelly or marmalade. What the hell's the difference between marmalade and jelly? I know what it is. I can spell jelly. Anyway, yeah, I need some of that that brain cell regeneration stuff. I'm losing them, man. I've got a counter on the back of my forehead. Back of my forehead? That doesn't make any sense. The back of my forehead? Wait a minute, where's that? You should be able to Google this. You should be able to go into Google, type your name in under braincells.com, not that there is one, I'm making it up, and it'll tell you individually how many brain cells you have left. I think that would be interesting. Then I can kind of monitor things, you know, like, whoa, I had tuna fish yesterday, and look, I got two more brain cells. Actually, brain cells, I understand. See, I've heard two schools of thought, because I went to two schools. I've done interviews on this show like forever, and some doctors say, yeah, you can increase your brain cell strength. Oh, and then other doctors say, no, once a brain cell dies, that's it. It never comes back. It's kind of like hair follicles. And again, some doctors say, no, you can regrow hair. And others say, no, you can't. Once the follicle's dead, it's over. So put these two people in a room, let them figure it out, and then get back to me with the answer, okay? I'm kind of sick of these dueling responses. I really am. Okay, we're going to take a tiny little break. When we come back, my guest will be joining me. And I didn't talk about Trump today, but there are apparently some people who don't care for him. I can't say that with a straight face because I hate his guts like you wouldn't believe. I don't hate the Republican Party. I hate those that follow this man blindly. That's what I hate. I don't like blind following in any regard at all. Like, okay, because you are who you are, I don't care what you say or what you do or how you say it or anything like that. If you say it, then it's gold. I will kiss your ass. Where can I put my tongue? I mean, that's just a little pathetic. Yeah, I guess I wouldn't call it, I wouldn't say I hate them. I'd say that it's just a pathetic look on you. It's like wearing striped pants and a checkered T-shirt. It's not a good look on you. We'll talk to our expert about the shape of things in the world as far as influence is concerned right after this.
Hey, Ron, good morning. How are you?
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Dr. John Ganz joins us now. He's the Director of Communications and Research at Perry World House. And my goodness, and he's also, knows all about the National Security Council, has been involved as a White House insider and speechwriter also. You've done everything, John.
I've had some fun and gone around, so it's been a good time.
You've actually penned a book, I understand, which is called The White House Warriors. It's how the National Security Council transformed the American way of war. When did you write this book?
So I started it as a, it was part of my dissertation when I was getting my PhD from Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And I finished the dissertation before I went into government and worked as chief speechwriter at the Pentagon for a few years in the Obama administration. And when I got out of the Obama administration, I sort of had a, you know, belief that there was interest out there in understanding better how government worked.
Yep.
And I thought, especially with the election of Donald Trump, there would be a sort of a real fascination with, you know, how government worked.
Yes.
And how it's supposed to work and how it doesn't work. And so I thought this would be a good opportunity to write the book. And so far the response has been great. A lot of interest and a lot of people who are surprised to learn about this little unknown piece of government and how it shaped the world we all live in.
It is fascinating, and of course, everything now in government is more interesting than it was before. Actually, it was probably always interesting, but I think the public kind of understands that things are a little, we don't know what's going to happen-ish.
Yeah, the stakes are a little higher, I guess.
Yeah, I would think so. And I know that behind the National Security Council is always the concern about keeping world order. And dealing with that behind the scenes, the American public, and I believe even members of Congress, don't really even know what's really going on behind the scenes.
No, I mean, it's sort of, you know, one of those moments in American history, and I think we've lived through a few of these, is that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of desire to understand what's happening behind the scenes, whether you're in Tehran, Pyongyang, Beijing, or even down, you know, at the Pentagon or on Capitol Hill, and trying to understand just what's going on behind the scenes. And what I tried to do, in part because these are the stories that I just loved listening to and learning about when I was in government and love reading about in history, is try to, like, open up the behind the scenes and show sort of the order and disorder that goes on behind some of the biggest decisions in the world. And I profile from, in the book, White House Warriors, from Truman to Trump, some of the behind-the-scenes players, people you've never heard of, people like Michael Forrestal, people like Megan O'Sullivan, people like Richard Haass, who you might have some vague knowledge of their names, but you have, most people have no idea that these few people have helped shape the world you live in. And what I wanted to do is expose them to their accomplishments to the public, but also, you know, some of their ideas weren't the best ones, and I wanted to make sure that the public was aware that they of what they've been up to and what they've done.
We spoke to Richard Haass not long ago, and it was interesting. Mm-hmm. I could tell by his demeanor that his concern was greater now than it had been in the past. Although there've been many reasons for concern in the past as well, and he's been around a while. But there seems to be, at this juncture in our government, not an understanding of who's actually running it.
I tell the story of Richard Haass before he was Richard Haass, right? Mm-hmm. I tell the story of when he was a staffer working for George H.W. Bush and a gentleman who was national supervisor named Brent Scowcroft. And I tell the story of how they came together and helped come up with the ideas to fight the Gulf War back in 1990 and 1991. And that was really the modern American government got its legs, and really the systems and processes those guys put in place.
Yes.
And what I'd say is that Trump was always going to be a tough fit for that order, right? Because, you know, he's such an irregular president, never served in government, never served in the military, never did those sorts of things. But what he's done is helped bring about the destruction of that order.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a system, you have really no system in place.
Right.
And just a lot of personalities who were sort of, based on public reports, not getting along right now.
Yeah.
So it's a really, I think, for a guy like Richard Haass, who was so used to the system and appreciated the system, to see something like that, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my bet is that's where his concern is coming from, as is mine.
Yeah, that was the exact concern, the fact that these agencies and these councils were trusted to have the knowledge and the acumen to run their course with the greatest of expertise, and now that is being actually, in some cases, defied, and it's just so different. Although I understand... go on.
No, I mean, and I think the system wasn't perfect, and I think there's a tendency between these, you know, old timers, and I think that's one of the funny things about this book so far is the response has been really interested outside the Beltway, but people in the Beltway are kind of like, well, we want to do things the way we've always done things, and I think one of the challenges you run into is the system wasn't exactly working well before Trump was elected. You know, there's a reason Donald Trump was elected.
Right.
I think there was a lot of dissatisfaction with Washington,
including
our foreign policy. And so I think there wasn't a great system in place, and I think the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan demonstrate some of the challenges afoot. But what you have is, you know, the frustrations of that system have now been completely, and the disappointments of the system have been lost with any of the benefits.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I think that's where you run into a really scary moment.
Yeah, well, you don't replace a turd with a bucket of pee. Interesting, in your book, you bring up Nixon's reign there, and that he had considered the use of nuclear weapons to finally to end the war in Vietnam. And what struck me was there seems to be a comparison. If Nixon was a rebel in that sense, obviously not necessarily listened to his establishment, do Trump and Nixon both have that in common, where they pretty much overrode what the experts were saying?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about it is that the year sort of 1969 is, I think, one of the most fascinating moments of American history, in part because you had a lot of the seeds get set for what would later happen with Richard Nixon. It was when the first wiretaps were put in place that sort of helped grow into the Watergate scandal.
Right.
It was actually put on a National Security Council staff member, somebody I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. You had this sort of effort to sort of basically ignore the bureaucracy and get away from the military's opinions.
Right.
And this descent into total secrecy and control.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difference between, you know, Nixon and Trump is two things, which is Nixon hated government in part because he had worked in government for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually knew, and his reasons for being frustrated were based in some germ of reality, which was, you know, he came in and was like, the government hasn't solved Vietnam, so why should I trust the government to help me solve Vietnam?
Right.
Donald Trump doesn't have that experience. The second thing is I think Richard Nixon had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that I find that and people are surprised about the discussion of nuclear weapons and the fact that his White House considered it in 1969, is because it's totally at peace with what he was saying, which is we just have to just hit them so hard and hit North Vietnam so hard that they'll give up.
Right.
And so it kind of makes sense that they would at least consider nuclear weapons, whereas you don't see that level of strategic vision coming from President Trump in the sense of his seems to be much more just improvisational, whereas Nixon's was much more strategic.
Right.
But neither of them good. But certainly, I think most people would probably take some of the sort of, at least on foreign policy, some of the decisions that Richard Nixon made over what Donald Trump's been doing.
Well, unfortunately, we have a certain amount of time here limited. I could talk to you for hours. We didn't even talk about the U.S.-China relations and, my God, all the stuff going on and how that was handled through the decades. The book is fascinating. It covers all of that. I wouldn't say it raises more questions than not, but it certainly opens your eyes into history that most of us had no idea was occurring under the covers. It's called White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. Available everywhere, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and it's getting a great pickup and a great amount of response.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be traveling around and would love to come back and keep talking China and everything else.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Is there a way that people can follow you?
Yes, you can get me on Twitter, which is John Gans, J-R, so J-O-H-N-G-A-N-S-J-R on Twitter, and my website's also johngans.com.
Perfect. Hey, great talking to you, John.
Good talking with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was both interesting and scary. I like the combination. I'll have the interesting plus a little scary on the side, please. Is that all right with you? I'm done for today. Stick a fork in me. I'm done. Oh, old joke. That's really not even funny. I am not a piece of meat, although I have been called that, and I have called other people that, and I apologize. In the meantime, I'm done. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new show. Until then, I wish you peace.